You mean this? Oh, no, you mean this.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of any of these people?
Yeah, they're all my favorite strippers down at...
It sounds it, right? Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rody, it's now available through Amazon and paperback Kindle or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show. Today, I bring to you the Licorice Quartet, Eric Dover, Roger Manning, and Tim Smith. You may know them as being former members of the band Jellyfish. Eric Dover has also played with Slash's Snake Pit, Imperial Drag, Sextus, sorry, I messed up your band name, Sextus, and Alice Cooper. Roger Joseph Manning Jr. was also an Imperial Drag. He was in the band Moog Cookbook. In addition, he's toured and recorded with Jay-Z, Beck, Blink-182, and Johnny Cash. Had to extenuate that because that is so cool. Third guest, Tim Smith. In addition to being in Jellyfish, he's also toured with Noel Gallagher of Oasis, Sheryl Crow, and Sarah McLachlan. So my first question here, I like to ask you guys, what are the strangest gigs you've ever done? You know, the funny stories and stuff like that. And I did dig up that a couple of you guys were in the Brady Bunch movie. And I think that comes up with kind of random. How did you guys get into this Brady Bunch thing? And was it fun or was it, did you like hanging with TV people?
Eric, whatever you remember about this, please jump in. My memory, it's getting cloudier now because it's starting to be quite a few years back, but Eric and I were working together to put ideas together for what was going to become Imperial Drag, and we were introduced to some drummers, and then I think, well, Will Sharp knew David Darling, if I'm not mistaken, because he managed him and his band. There were a local band here called Boxing Gandhis. Does that sound right, Eric?
Yeah, that's right.
And David was a very successful musician around town, as was
his... Hold on, if you picked Boxing Gandhis, what were the outtakes that didn't quite make the cut for the name of the band?
Yeah, exactly. You'd have to ask David. I'm sure he's still around.
Boxing Gandhis. Okay, sorry.
He had his hand in so many different things around town, and he was actually got the call to put the live background band together for Davy Jones's music scenes, performing scenes in the movie. And he knew Eric and I through our mutual management.
Got it.
And I think he'd been a Jellyfish fan, so he knew who we were. So he completely went out on a lark, or whatever the phrase is, asked us to, if we wanted to be in the backing band. It was just like a, you know, fun serendipitous thing. And we jumped at the idea. The whole thing seemed so surreal to me anyway. They're making some Brady Bunch movie. So I'm like, sure, I'll go be a stand-in. I need the paycheck. Yeah, that's how that happened. And it was a long, you know, it was shot at Taft High School, which is in the Valley. And they had, you know, 300 extras and us all being shot on that day for the cafeteria rock concert. And so, you know, when you're not shooting, you just have to go into your compartment and be quiet and kill time.
Did you have your own dressing room, Eric?
Oh, it was a chemistry lab. I think we were all in.
Chemistry lab.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was on the campus and it was blazing hot Valley morning and you had to stay in your costume and you had to stay in makeup. So it was actually a colossal pain in the ass. I mean, it was really fun hanging out with Eric and David and the guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, but once you were on stage, you had to like behave and be serious and do your job and pretend like you were playing. And Davy Jones was there, so that was kind of fun to see him. But there were I don't think there were any other actors or actresses. Maybe the woman that played Marcia, Ben Stiller's wife. Blah blah blah. Anyway, I'm thankful for that crazy pop culture
indeed
moment.
So I did reach out to Dizzy Reed today, a good buddy, and I said, "What can you tell me about Eric so I can pick on him?" So he, please just tell him that I miss playing with him and hanging with him. He's amazing on so many levels, and we've had some great times together. This fucking Guns N' Roses guy is very serious. But then he did tell him, "Stand down, human." I'm supposed to tell you that. Don't know what it means, but there you go.
Oh, right, right. Well, that's the that's what you're supposed to say. Like, you've been through Hollywood before around the Scientology Center, where they'll come up and accost you, the Scientologists. And what you're supposed to say, if you don't want them to bother you, is to make them think you're a Scientologist.
Ah. And
you simply say to them, "Stand down, human." But
well, that's a life lesson.
Yeah,
I think I learned that from Chris Wise, actually, that plays with the Cult. He taught me that one.
Good to know.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to pick on you here. I typed in Eric Dover trivia, and I found this website. So what do you think your net worth is?
I can tell you that it's $50 and a ham sandwich.
No, you're wrong. It's $1,431,656.
Is that
as of 2022? It says the estimated net worth includes stocks, properties, luxury goods, and yachts and private airplanes.
You know, I forgot about the yacht. That was where I messed up. Yeah.
Tim already knows this, but 91% of people say that Eric is hot, which Tim knew.
Oh. And great. Then,
similar artists, so maybe you have heard of these guys. I haven't, and I didn't look them up. But Kirsty McGee, Diablo Dimes, Genevieve Castree, Kyla Lagrange, Khalid Salim. Have you ever heard of any of these people?
Yeah, they're all my favorite strippers down at...
It sounds it, right? Anyway, that's your fan base. Good job, Eric.
That's awesome.
Yeah, good stuff, huh?
Yeah, me and Diablo, we're like this.
Yeah.
All right, so memory lane. So it's, I don't know if you'll remember, Eric, but I actually lived literally next door to Andy Strummer. And he's a quiet guy, man. The guy didn't talk to me much. So I went over there. I saw him outside. I'm like, I was trying to like, but hey, you know, I know music. I did music. Oh, yeah. I'm like, I'm friends with Eric Dover. Is that okay? And I remember he kind of looked at me and he's like, Yeah, it's okay. I'm like, good. All right.
He didn't spray you with a garden hose or anything?
He didn't really say much. It's really hard to get that guy to talk to you or anything. He was nice. he went on my deck and just played bad music for like 8 hours. Like, here you go. It was funny. So you guys, a little reading. So the Jellyfish thing started. You guys were really young when you put it together, yeah? The band together.
When Eric and Tim joined Jellyfish?
Yeah, because I was reading a bit. So you were still, you knew Andy from like high school or something. Like the band goes way back to then.
No, I do know Andy from high school. We hung out then and were friends and had a couple of band projects, but none of them were Jellyfish, nor were they related. We went our separate ways after high school, and it wasn't until after college that I moved back up to San Francisco from where I had been going to school and joined a project he had then. And then that project broke up and then Jellyfish was born. So that wasn't until 89.
And then how did you get involved with it, Eric?
Through Tim, actually. So it's kind of this big circle because Tim was playing in a band called The Producers, which you should know if you don't. And my band was opening for The Producers at the time. So it was an open audition.
Oh, that's neat. And then now, and then all the, and you guys have always stayed in touch, all you guys.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, the time flies, but we reconnected in 2017 for the Licorice Quartet project.
Right.
We reached out to each other and just kind of played with the idea of writing some original music and let's see what happens.
Oh,
and then 5 years flew by.
Yeah, well, time goes by quick. And Imperial Drag, do you guys think you would be doing more stuff? Or
I still am trying to figure out a way to release some live material and some demos in a package. But there have been other things that have taken my attention away from that, like Licorice Quartet. I was much more interested in helping to create a new project of original material. I think there is an audience out there that would welcome some of the old Imperial Drag stuff. I hope to be able to figure out a way to do that.
Yeah. Now, speaking of original material, it's probably bad on me, but so when I met Eric, I'm like 23, 24, I'm thinking, and I thought Jet was your song. You played it with such passion and you played it every week. And I thought that it was you guys.
Right. And that's kind of a weird thing because, Jellyfish covered Jet long before I joined the band, and I think in a Badfinger song as well. So when I sent the demo into audition for Jellyfish, I actually sent a cover of No Matter What by Badfinger. So I guess we were just all into the same kind of, you know, old tunes, you know, like that.
Remember that? And when you played Ballroom Blitz, I loved it. I don't know. Crushed it.
Yep. The Sweet. I quite like them.
Great band. Yeah. Okay. So were any of your guys' parents musicians? Were they always supportive of you guys being musicians?
Well, neither of my parents were musicians at all. However, they were both very supportive against their better judgment. I mean, they supported music lessons early on because they understood how important it was for the brain to be activated in that way beyond the public schooling system.
And the music lessons were piano always, or?
Piano and drums.
Oh.
Well, actually, there were no official drum lessons, but they didn't discourage me from drumming and learning from my friends and practicing drums. But I had actual piano lessons they paid for, and they sent me to music school after I graduated.
And
the whole time, bless their hearts, they were like, okay, well, you really maybe should minor in business, please, for God's sakes, do that. And they're always quoting the statistics of how many musicians and people with talent actually make a career out of that.
You're like, Mick Jagger.
Which they're, I mean, you know, my uncle, who was a drummer in the 60s, he's my dad's younger brother.
Okay.
That's what he started out doing and providing for his family and here in Los Angeles. And, you know, I know he had a blast. I've talked to him about it many times, and he was smack dab in the epicenter of the Sunset Strip scene in the mid to late 60s with the Doors and Love and Iron Butterfly and all those Los Angeles bands. He was in a band called Davy Allen and the Arrows, but parlaying all of that into providing for his family proved to be very challenging. Yeah. And ultimately him and his wife split but he played in Vegas bands and so forth into his 30s. The point is that from my parents' perspective, you know, it was a challenging and troubled life that created unnecessary stress, and ultimately he couldn't make it work. And then every time I talked to my uncle, he was like, yeah, man, those were the best years of my life. Like, I wouldn't have traded that for anything. He goes, I had a blast. Are you kidding? To be a part of that world and to, like, you know, be a fly on the wall and be active in it in some way. He goes, I wouldn't have traded it for anything. But, you know, I mean, thankfully I had a lot of my dad's practical side that would balance my fantastical ideological musician artist side. So while I don't claim to be a master of finances by any stretch of the imagination, I've never had a problem making sure that stuff that I was getting involved in had either the potential for commerce or was already established in some kind of business model. From Jellyfish to Licorice Quartet and everything in between, I always believed our musical offerings were had the ability to relate to a wide variety of people in their sing along, sure. You know, aspect.
Sure.
Now actually making that happen through the business model of the record companies and then what it's become today through files in the Spotify world, et cetera, that's a different story. Crazy, I, you know, yeah. I can't, right. I don't, nobody can master that, but yeah. I felt that I had enough of a, in other words, I didn't feel any of these projects were so highfalutin underground art, conceptual art that they were going to outright alienate vast swaths of generic pop culture. So, I mean, because, you know, we were spoiled. We, all of our heroes were the Police and Peter Gabriel and Talking Heads and all these conceptual art rock pop bands that were really great song craftsmen.
Are you English, Tim? Hold on. Yeah. I think I heard Tim say something. Are you English, Tim? I think I heard you say something briefly in the beginning.
No, I'm not. I'm married to an English person.
Oh, there you go. Because all the bands you just said were English, so I was going to make English joke, but forget it. We'll just skip that.
Well, Talking Heads were American, and
poor
I could
Tim,
throw
I'm
REM.
I'm going to ask you stuff know. Next, but anyway, sorry. Oh, that's right. They are. Yeah, yeah, of course.
You know, REM, I mean, it's like, there were so many. I mean, even Prince was just like every album just trying to take pop rock into a whole different place. And he did. Oh, yeah. But there was enough hooky, catchy, dancey elements to it that it always had the potential. He finally cracked it on his third record, you know, to connect with a large population. So,
yeah.
But it's a delicate dance because you have to be true ideally to what you want to do and what you want to say.
Yeah.
But I always felt that there were enough elements that were relatable to a larger group of people and various age groups and generations.
That's cool. Were your parents still around? And if they are still around, didn't mean to be rude, but when you were, did you record with Johnny Cash, or you toured with them, or what did you do with Johnny Cash?
Well, thanks to Rick Rubin, who basically revived his career and did, I believe, what, 4 projects with him of recordings, did a lot of covers. I got asked to play keyboards on a portion of those recordings. And it was just me and Rick and the engineer. Johnny was never there. I think he was barely hanging on back home.
Yeah.
But it was amazing to be brought into those recordings and just hear like an acoustic guitar and his voice.
Oh, yeah.
It was just weird and really cool and kind of a pinch me moment.
Yeah, it is. What about you, Tim? Were your parents supportive of you going into music?
Right back.
Yeah, they were. They were. Gosh, I had some cousins who were a bit older than me that were kind of hippies in the 60s and stuff, and I had their guitars after they were older. So I remember waiting and getting my first electric guitar from my mom's older sister's kids and stuff. But yeah, you know, they had a piano and a guitar, and I played in the school bands and stuff. But yeah, they were very successfully supportive. My dad would go to every show that we went, little teenage rock combo show that we did, or tried to get away with, you know, sneaking alcohol in our cases and stuff. So they understood.
You guys still do that? I know you do. Yeah, I know. And then Eric, did you play guitar first? Was that your first instrument? Or
yes. Well, pots and, if you don't count pots and pans, right? But my mom had a we lived in Nashville when I was 6. I actually lived just down the road from Johnny Cash's house.
Oh.
So we took, like, my grandparents came to visit us once, and we went to Johnny's house, and he had a guard shack, and my grandfather talked to the guard for a while about Johnny, and he was, like, so stoked about it. But this DJ in Nashville had given my mother a guitar because he had a crush on her, and that was sitting around the house for years. And then I think when I was about 11, we had some like hippies come live with us because my folks were splitting up, and the guy just smoked pot all day and like played Stairway to Heaven. And I kind of learned my first chords from him, basically.
That's a hell of a guitar teacher.
Was the guitar your mom got, was it an electric one?
No, it was an acoustic. It was a Stella. If mm-hmm. you remember those, kind of off brand, but I wish I had that guitar still. It wasn't very expensive, but you know, just for the memories of it. But
how long did it take? I guess all you guys. How long did it take you to think that you were actually good at it?
What time is it now?
Yeah, you must have known early on.
That's a good one. Yeah. I mean, I agree with Eric to a degree. I mean, if you're constantly trying to up the ante for yourself, personal best, all that stuff, it doesn't end. You know, I mean, I did more lead vocals on the Licorice Quartet stuff than I have in any combo group that I've been with. I shared in the lead vocal duties, and man, to get myself to sing up there with Tim and Eric and do like a killer lead vocal that held the song, not just like, well, that's as good as I can do, and that's pretty good for me. It's like, well, great, but it's got to like be the focal point and, you know, lead the tune. I mean, these guys don't even know how long I spent on some of my lead vocals, just over and over again. That sucks. Do it again. Blah blah blah. And some days you just have to stop because your voice isn't cooperating or you've worn it out. But I welcomed that challenge. It was good. It's great for me to practice doing that. And I'm in some ways I'm singing better now than I ever did and ever in Jellyfish, even though I'm in my 50s. And so you keep pushing yourself. But I remember I was in college practicing very seriously to be a, you know, music performer in a lot of like jazz area with keyboard and keyboard oriented, but performance. Mm-hmm. I loved playing other people's songs, especially when I thought they were cool and jamming over them. But it never occurred to me to write my own. And I had actually been corresponding with Andy because I was in Los Angeles and he was in San Francisco working on his projects. We'd make mixtapes for each other, and he had started trying to write original ideas, which is super weird for any drummer to like one day pick up a guitar and go, I want to do this, let alone sing them. And I couldn't figure out why he was like not showing off his drum abilities and why he was sending me song things that he was working on. And I thought they were cool, but I was like, wow, that's weird. And it just kept inspiring me to try that, which I did. And then it was like, this whole world opened up of freedom, because now suddenly I could create chord progressions and melodies sent against them. I wasn't interested in lyrics. I admired quality lyric writing, and I had lyrics I preferred, mm-hmm. and those that didn't inspire me, mm-hmm. but that did not inspire me to do it. I had no interest in writing lyrics. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that's cool. That's not, but I don't want to do that. But I did want to figure out that magic that happens when melodies and chords combine and make a person feel a certain way, meaning how they would make me feel. I mean, it's this weird masturbatory activity that then, if you pull it off, a whole bunch of people can like share in the pleasure, so to speak.
Eric, keep your hands on top of the desk.
Super weird. Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know.
He cracked an adult joke.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So all that is to say, I stopped practicing.
Yeah,
my jazz chords and scales, because I was so frustrated that I couldn't write a good song idea. I thought it was going to be fairly easy, and it was just crash and burn, crash. It was horrible. It was a very lonely experience that I would complain to my college roommates about, who weren't musicians, and they were very sweet and humored me. It was like, okay, we don't really care. and then 3 years later, I wrote the core of the song that was going to become Bye 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 on Spilt Milk.
Okay.
And that was the first idea that I'd come up with. I was like, hey, I think there's something there. And I'm so confident that there's something there. I'll play it for Andy. I'll play it for my girlfriend. I'll play it for my mom. And I really don't care if they like it or not, because I liked it. And that was a new weird feeling.
Yeah.
I could stand by an original piece of art, and I wanted more of that feeling. And it was very clear that the only way I was going to get better at that is you have to go to the gym and keep doing it.
And so, did you ever listen into the opening of this podcast?
Have I? No, sorry.
Little known fact, it's actually Eric.
Oh, from what, a Sextus song?
No, it's a song that I dragged Eric onto doing with me, and we made it fun. It was a song for a movie called The Gay Bed and Breakfast of Terror. And so we wrote the theme song for this film, and then we got fired because they hated my lyrics. I thought it was funny. They did not think so. And so we weren't able to use our song. And so the intro is actually Eric playing.
How about your podcast was? Yeah.
Yeah, well, these years later, so hey.
Well, you know those music directors, you know, they're hard to please.
Actually, it was the guy's birthday today. He's a nice guy, even though he hated our song. He's really nice. He still says hi to me. So hey,
awesome.
Yeah, kind of funny coincidence. I don't know. So when I was putting this together, a lot of my friends have kids now, and my friend's daughter's in fifth grade. She was with some of her little friends. They were excited about this podcast thing, and they said to me, "You should ask every guest when they first felt famous." So I ask each of you guys, when did you first feel famous? Now, if fame is not the answer you would choose for yourself because you don't think you're famous, I'm just saying maybe you do, maybe you don't. Where's a kernel in your career, is a moment in time that you would say is worth relating that made you proud of where you are today or who you are today? It's the hardest question from this little kid. And I've had the most amazing answers.
Yeah.
From literal answers of fame to very random little anecdotes. They're awesome. Yeah. Just really neat stuff. So
kids will do that.
Yeah. It's good stuff. So what would each of you think would be a good moment?
I've been hogging up the airtime. I'll go last.
Then we'll pick on Tim. Poor Tim.
Gosh, man, that's a. It's hard to say. I don't know what fame. What, you know, fame. I've been able to play with a lot of artists, and getting to hang out with other art. You know, I think I felt that when I was playing with Sheryl Crow and we opened for the Rolling Stones, and we're just kind of hanging out with the Rolling Stones. Something about that, and talking about music. Like, they clear the room of all the punters in the backstage area. Because we finished our set, they're about to go on. They just come in and play pool or snooker or whatever they do. And they let us stay there. And it just, you know, having Ron Wood come and bum a cigarette from you, it sounds silly, but I just felt like, well, I guess I've done something to get to this point that allows me this time, you know. And we were talking about things, you know, like as guitar players, not just, so how's it going, Mr. Rolling Stone? You know, was never like that. And I think that's when I finally just was like, well, I think I'm doing okay. You know?
Yeah.
That's mine.
Oh, that's a cool one.
Hey, Tim, do you play snooker at all?
No, I watched those guys do it. And I think the table's actually bigger than a normal pool table.
Yeah, and it has the things in the middle, right? The wood things?
Or something. You line them up differently. I've asked people about, can't you play it on a regular table? And they're like, well, you can, but it's not really the same. Angles and blah, blah, blah. But I don't
right,
know.
Such a different game.
Yeah, yeah.
You know how to play, Eric?
It's funny because in the last 3 days, I've developed some kind of interest that I want to play snooker and also want to learn how to play nine ball, which is a bit of a different kind of a pool game. So just to have something to do, you know.
Yeah.
But at the moment you're stuck in bumper pool in your room there? Is that what's happening?
Well, yeah, pocket pool, really.
Pocket pool. Hey.
A little carom board in elementary school where you click.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't have space for a pinball machine either, so.
I still have my pinball machine. I love my pinball machine.
Nice. What do you have, the Ted Nugent one?
Oh, I have.
I wish.
I wanted a Guns N' Roses one. And actually, so I was an art dealer for a lot of years, and I was at an auction, and they had the toppers, which is the plastic piece that goes on top of pinball machines, and they disappear a lot of the time because they're just flimsy. And they had a whole box of Guns N' Roses toppers, and I knew what they were. So I bought the box, which I think had six of them in there, and I sold them for like $500-$600 each. And I was like, oh, I'm doing this. And then I started selling art, and it all built from this box of plastic Guns N' Roses.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I had seen them in the storage, so I knew what they were. And right. It was random that I ran into them. So funny things work out. I don't know.
Totally.
Well, isn't Slash developing pinball machines, I think, in Chicago?
So he has a whole room of them. And then he did design the guns, one of the first one. There's another one I saw recently that was a Slash one that I'd never seen before. So maybe that's newish that he did. I'm not sure. But I know he's nuts on them. He loves them. So I just have the one. It's good enough for me, but they're fun.
We played a lot of pinball.
Yeah. Did you record up at his house ever?
The one on, up on like Wonderland around there.
Oh, the one. Okay.
That's the old house.
I almost rented the Wonderland murder house.
Ah.
I walked through it, but it didn't work out. But I was going to rent that house.
Yeah, Slash had a house on Sunset Plaza.
Okay.
For a while, when we were working together, at least. And he had he had about four or five pinball machines. He had Captain Fantastic.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Guns N' Roses, and a pet cougar, so...
Yeah, we talked about the cougar on the one with Dizzy. It was, what was the cougar's name?
Curtis, I think.
I think it is Curtis.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dizzy threw his back out because the cougar jumped on his back.
What happened? That'll happen.
That will happen. That will happen. That was one of the stories he let me keep. I had to cut a bunch of his stories out because he was like, why are you bringing this up? And I'm like, because it's a great story. He's like, cut it. You know, I will tell you. This is years ago. I was talking to him and I asked him, so who's the most talented guy you ever worked with? And I expected him to say Axl because I was a huge Guns N' Roses fan. And you know what he said? He said Eric Dover. He really did. I swear it's a true story. He said you were the most talented guy. And it wasn't prompted, nothing. He said that you're the most talented guy you ever worked with. Isn't that cool?
There you
go. I don't know if he remembers it now, but he did.
Well, Dizzy and I have had such fun together. I mean, it's indescribable. I mean, it's much, you know, the same kind of fun that we've had being in Jellyfish together and Imperial Drag, you know. So that's really sweet of him.
That's cool. What's your guys' moments? Do you have anything that comes to mind?
For me, really, things went into hyperspace as soon as the first Jellyfish album came out, because coinciding with that was an acceptance from MTV to start supporting us as much as possible, which every band launching dreams of. So what that meant was a video presence with simultaneous albums in the stores and starting to work at college radio. And so that all happened within a few months. So went from no fame, if you will, or just local fame, to being somewhere on the other side of the States or in Europe and being recognized, and that to the point of, oh, I don't know what to do with this, because my life up to this point has not prepared me for how to gracefully engage with fans and all that stuff. But the most exciting moment for me, not unlike what Tim was talking about with the Stones, was being in a record store on a day off in Hamburg or someplace in Germany.
Yeah.
And Andy and I were record shopping, and we happened to be looking in the same area together. And we were over by the, you know, JK LMNOP. So we're looking at stuff, and we both go, oh, there's us. There was like a Jellyfish section.
Oh, neat.
And I could tell, even though we were standing like 4 feet apart from each other, it was like, whoa, this is actually for real now. Like, this record that we fantasized about doing, you know, 3.5 years ago has now gone through all those steps, any one of which could have fallen apart and the whole thing would be over.
Yeah.
And then by some miracle, all those steps happened, and they happened for better, for worse, and whatever level. But we've arrived here in a mom and pop record store in Hamburg, Germany. And that's all we ever wanted, kind of thing. It was like, that great.
That's
I never thought that would happen. And here it is. So that was a very powerful moment for me. And I think he and I talked about it a little bit later, but we didn't even have to say anything. I could tell we were both on a
woohoo
mind meld about that. Yeah, exactly.
I was in Florida with STP, and I was in the record store with Robert DeLeo, the bass player, and the STP Core album was in the dollar bin. I'm like, hey, look.
Wow.
Yeah, he's just like, yeah, fuck you.
That can happen too.
Yeah, well.
And it does.
Now there's no dollar bin even. It doesn't even matter. Now it's just the downloads of everything. I don't, it's nuts.
Oh, man. Some of the best records I ever bought, though, were from the cutout bin, you know.
So for sure, you know, way back, we had the warehouse here in California. I don't know if they were nationwide, honestly. And before the computer system ran stuff, it was whoever was behind the counter. And if they'd never heard of the band, it's a buck or whatever, there was no system. And I'd get all this great stuff that I didn't know was great either until you start listening to it, which is what's so fun about music. And I love all that time. And there's no such thing now. You can pop around Spotify, let's say, and maybe they prompt you to various things, but it's not the same feeling as listening to a whole album of somebody somewhere you'd never heard of. And you're like, how?
Now, well, I mean, you just reminded me how crucial the buyers of those stores were, particularly the chains.
Yeah.
They were DJs in their own right, right? They furthered the hype or steered a local community to get into this new Rush record that nobody knew about or wasn't talking about. And it could, like, you know,
Sims, the conglomerate of independent music stores. They were the ones distributing through Sims, I think. But yeah, it was the same. If you're not on that list, it's tough to get going. Same with what you were saying. Get on MTV. Finally, you can make some movement. Don't get on MTV. How are they going to find you? But now it's the Twitters and all this other stuff, which is honestly hard. I don't know. There's a lot of all of that stuff. So
there's a ton of traffic. I don't, at the end of the day, I don't know how anybody breaks through doing anything that they're offering. I seem to see for the most part now it's, well, what starts happening, you start centralizing and reducing everything to the lowest common denominator. So a fashion person does well with her clothing line, not so much because of the clothes, but her fans, like an actress, aspire to her. Oh, we like the way she looks. We wish we could be her.
Yeah.
Which is how often acting careers take off for men or women. It's not so much they're a good or bad actor. It's the mass portion of the population identify with them, aspire to be them, see themselves in them. And it goes from there. So I think that's how you have a lot of it.
You might be guilty of the same. You might have been on the music end of things, but it was the same. You're trying because of somebody who's, you know, better than you are, you think, when you're a kid, maybe.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. I mean, sure, there may have been 30 bands I liked in any given year, but I related to a handful of those, or the lead singer or the main songwriter or keyboard player, for different reasons above the other ones.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. And I was like, oh, that's the model. If you combine this dude, and this woman here, I want to be some version of this as a keyboard player, you know?
Yeah. Were you a big Alice Cooper fan, Eric, before?
I've grown up with Alice Cooper since the time I could, you know, basically start spinning records. And it started with the Greatest Hits record.
Well, you had older brothers and sisters, right? You had an older sister.
Older sister, yeah. So she brought home Alice Cooper's Greatest Hits and Bad Company, Leader of the Pack in the same day. And then we were all into our Elton John records. So Captain Fantastic was actually the first record that I, LP that I ever bought. And she brought home Goodbye Yellow Brick Road the same day. So I had two Elton John records, like, and it just totally took my life over. Mm-hmm. That and the movie version of Tommy. not the original one, but the movie version I much prefer. Oh. I know it sounds horrible. Brian Kehew, don't kill me.
You got a moment you want to share? Can you tell this little kid?
A moment?
A moment that first comes to mind, maybe we can say, where you you're proud of it happening in your career. Made you feel good. You felt successful.
Actually, joining Jellyfish was a huge deal for me. I was so happy to be around. because when that first record Belly Button came out, it was instantaneous. Literally every musician that I knew of that was worth their salt had Belly Button.
Yeah.
And I was one of them. I mean, I was, actually I was spinning Belly Button and Dear 23 by the Posies, because I, you know, love that record as well to this day. And so there was a lot of star treatment that Jellyfish received, during our tenure. Playing on the Jules Holland show was a pretty big deal. And, meeting Leonard Cohen, that was a huge deal.
Oh yeah.
Where
did you guys meet Leonard Cohen?
On the Jules on Holland show.
So yeah. He performed on it with you?
Yeah, you know that show that he does where all the bands are set up in the room together and you're all playing and you're watching the other bands play. So his band was set up over here and we were over here. I can't remember who else was on the show. Do y'all remember who else was on that?
Was it Aztec Camera?
It might have been, or Roddy Frame, maybe.
Roddy Frame?
I think you're right. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've done it with some other artists too. It's a unique concept, but it's definitely, it's weird to watch somebody, like, while you're trying to do your thing, watch, you know, Leonard Cohen just standing there watching you. There's nothing weird about that at all.
What are some of the guys that have been at there, some of the shows you guys have done where you're looking on and it's like, oh, there's Ringo Starr just watching me play.
Oh,
it's like, well, Elton John. So I had John Mayen on, and John has been with Elton John for a very, very, very long time. And his was Sting. He said, he's like, Sting is literally standing right next to me, just staring at my percussion.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had Sting come to some shows with Sheryl Crow, and they worked together, and he's a tough nut to crack, especially, yeah. I was playing bass at the time, and it's just like, I don't know what's going to happen here. I think he talked to me about yoga more than bass, but that was okay.
Yeah.
It was a little weird.
Well, thankfully, when Cheap Trick were at a Jellyfish show, the A&R person that invited them to see our show, this was in Rockville, Illinois, thankfully he was smart enough not to tell us they were going to be arriving before we went on stage, so we found out afterwards. But we did not meet them then, or it was later. No, we did. It wasn't as we walked off stage. We hung out much later in the evening. Anyway, that's not important. And then when I played in Japan doing some solo stuff with Eric Skotos, who used to be in Imperial Drag, he was drumming for me at the time, and Linus of Hollywood and Aaron Kaplan, they were the band. Again, thankfully, nobody told me the two brothers from Sparks, the male brothers, were watching from the side. I knew they were on the premises because they had a show later that night, and a couple of my friends were playing in their touring band at the time.
Yeah.
But I had no idea that they were watching any of the show, and I think my nerves might have crippled me and gotten the best of me if I'd known that they were actually there.
Yeah.
Even though I couldn't see them. But I was glad that they saw what they did. I thought I had a generally good show.
Yeah.
And certainly there were plenty of moments that were, you know, completely influenced by them. I hope they picked up on it with a sense of flattery.
Yeah. That's what music's about. Were you intimidated at all when you first started working with Slash, Eric, or no? I mean, you're a pretty amazing guitar player. I'm not going to take anything from you, but.
Well, it happened so fast. That was the beauty of it. And you really, I just came out to LA to work with Roger. So we were very knee deep in working on our songs at the time when the Slash audition happened for me.
And I think, Red Roger, you're the one who told him to go do it, right?
Well, actually, a drummer we were auditioning at the time was the one that hooked the whole thing up.
Oh.
He was friends with Slash's camp of people.
Okay.
Oh, I absolutely encouraged Eric to go do that for many, many reasons. Eric was making a huge sacrifice, an investment, that's the word, in his future by leaving his home in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And coming to California and camping out at friend's house. He stayed at my place briefly off and on. And it was not a quick process for he and I to put material together and demo it that we believed in, shopping to managers and labels and trying to get the Imperial Drag Project off the ground. So when that opportunity came along, I was like, oh my God, you know, not as in a golden opportunity for you. And clearly, you know, me and all these other people think you're the right man for the job. I mean, we didn't know what was going to happen. But I thought just from a practical sense, you know, get some money into your pocket if you're going to relocate to California, because we seem to be getting serious about this band project. And then, of course, you know, it was like it was supposed to be a limited time commitment that got elongated. So it was a double-edged sword. And Eric and I, you know, and the other guys in Imperial Drag, we all worked through this. But, you know, ultimately, I only view it as a positive, not a negative, except for the conversation I had to have face-to-face with Slash on the phone.
But what?
I was like, give me my singer back, motherfucker.
Enough is enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it you know, I was pretty emotionally invested in what we were doing.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get back, and Slash did want me to stay, but I don't think he's ever really forgiven me for it. But he had to understand that we were under contract by the time I got off tour. So we were kind of legally obligated as well to do the Imperial Drag record. So
when you first played, I guess for him, I don't know. When you first played for him, were they kind of like looking at you like you're a badass, or were they a stone? Would you walk out of there going like, I have no idea how that went, or were you kind of like, wow, they like me, they really like me?
No, I went to his old house on up on, you know, around Wonderland there. It was condemned because of the earthquake. So he just had his home studio in there, and he took his guitar tech, Adam Day, and I sat there on a multi-track recorder. And that's when he played what became Beggars and Hangers-On. And I kind of wrote the lyrics, you know, got the lyrics started on the spot. And then he played it for Slash the next day, and Slash called me pretty immediately after that. So I didn't really start singing for the guys until a bit later over at Mates.
Okay.
So it happened so fast, it was kind of hard to be afraid. You know, you just kind of had to go in and do it.
You know, back in the Cat Club days, did you ever sing on stage with Lemmy?
Yes, I did.
Damn. Yeah.
Isn't that neat?
Wow.
Damn.
Yeah, so, I loved Lemmy, man.
I remember he would do a lot of Beatles songs. I remember that. So, and you too, though. Did you guys sing Beatles together? Or, you know, I don't remember as well as I should with some of this stuff, but.
Yeah, I had a drinking problem even worse than I do now back then.
Well,
so.
Me too. We had so much fun, man. We I remember Kenny behind the bar, we'd close the bar at like 2 or whatever, poor Slim Jim, and we would just all drink, party all night, and we'd kick everybody out we didn't know or whatever. We'd have so much fun there. But yeah. I remember you guys would keep playing sometimes, and so like watching Slim Jim play the drums, you know, fuck, he's good. And then the Lemmy, and then Jimmy Fallon hanging out, and just all this randomness of it was so much. You just never knew who would be there, and your ability to like morph and play with everybody was so cool to watch.
We you know, those were some very fun days. A lot of partying. I remember CeCe DeVille showing up one night, and we played Johnny B. Good, and he was so fucked up that he didn't know 1-4-5 like at all. I don't know. I think I got behind him on the guitar, and I was kind of propping him up and like, you know, fingering the chords, you know. He was pretty gone, but I think he's straightened up a bit now. But
I hear
a lot of that random stuff would happen. Fist fights, gotten a few of those. Just, you know, stuff I'm ashamed of now, but I mean, it's kind of fun that I lived through it at least.
Do you think Slim Jim will ever open up another bar?
I don't know. He's doing pretty well though. I talked to him a fair bit.
Do you?
Yeah, we keep in touch. I mean, Slim Jim's one of my favorite people on planet Earth.
Such because, a good dude.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just because if you get us into any Monty Python banter, it's, you know, he goes deep, so he knows the entire cycling episode. And so we just live like that for, you know, days on end when we were out playing together. We used to play casinos and do a lot of stuff like that as well.
That's good. Do you keep in touch with Gilby or?
I talked to Gilby not too terribly long ago. We were playing we had a little thing called Halloween Jack with Stephen Perkins from Jane's Addiction and Daniel Shulman, who plays with Garbage and played with a bunch of people. Little side project, but everybody got busy. So we got together and played and said hi for a bit.
Yeah,
he's doing great. He's Gilby.
I see him a lot. We have mutual friends. I don't know him too well, but I see him all the time at mutual buddies' houses all the time. So anyway, I'm getting astray here. Licorice Quartet. What are you guys going to tour or what's in the workings for you guys? We're early on. I know we're just releasing your materials. So,
well, yeah, I mean, we just by some awesome miracle, we actually got all the way through to EP number 3.
Yeah.
Which has just come out. And then coinciding with that has been this awesome deal with Japan. The whole point of which was to coalesce most of the material from the 3 EPs. There's 2 bonus songs that are covers that we did as a group during lockdown. And it's really exciting to see that all come together in one package for people.
Right behind you, isn't it?
Go ahead, what?
Did I see it sitting right behind you on your piano?
You're correct. Here.
Ah, yeah.
Product placement.
I got the box of them, but I haven't really scoped it out yet.
You mean this?
Awesome.
Oh no, you mean this?
Yeah. Very cool.
See how nice that came out?
Yeah, it looks great.
And this is the back. I mean, they did an incredible job on the packaging.
Yeah. Do you guys know if you're going to do any shows? Are you guys out gigging right now or?
We weren't really set up to do that. We don't really have a full-time drummer or anything, even though we're a quartet. There's only 3 of us.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really in the cards. I mean, we thought about it, and then, of course, lockdown happened. So, you know, it's nowadays touring just – we're all, you know, hired as side musicians for different things. I'm about to go out with Sheryl Crow again this summer.
Okay.
Due to one of her guitar players having some health issues or his wife having health issues. But – he can't go out and risk getting COVID because she's going through some cancer treatments. So, you know, those kind of crazy things are happening all over for people. So we haven't really been able to even consider playing live. It's not really been in our cards yet. You know, if somebody wants to pay us a lot of money to go play, I think we'd consider it.
Eric has a lot of money. Look,
I know he's worth at least $1 million. Plasma though. I think that's all
a
plasma.
Cool million.
Oh, man. Yeah. You could buy more cats, Eric.
Yeah,
I'm fine with the 2 I have.
Okay.
Well, guys, it's prohibitively expensive though, right now, especially touring. I mean, it's kind of out of the question for 99% of everyone.
Yeah.
So
that and a lot of the big acts are touring, so they're taking all the spaces. So
yeah,
they need the money.
Yeah, we don't have a touring bus that runs on cooking oil like Willie Nelson's, you know.
Yeah. Well, I do appreciate your guys' time. If you have any more funny stories to share, amusing gigs that come to mind that you had done once upon a time or anything, tell me. Otherwise.
Well, I was thinking about your fame story. I would give you a nice little story to counterbalance my Rolling Stone one, which was when I was in Jellyfish.
Yeah.
We played... I think it was called the Dick Clark's Rockin' Something Show. Do you guys remember when we played that? It was a TV show that you film it and then it's shown at a later date or whatever.
It's on YouTube.
Yeah. So we did that. I get home to Atlanta. we're not really touring, or there's a bunch of time off, and I'm helping a buddy of mine who has a carpet cleaning company, and I'm at this house, I'm helping him clean carpets, and I look over and this lady goes, "You look familiar to me." And I'm like, "Yeah, really?" And she goes, "I saw you," because the show had just shown the night before, "I saw you playing with jellyfish on the thing." And I'm like, "Yep, that's me." And I'm just steam cleaning her carpet. So
that's great.
So yeah, so fame is a fickle friend, I guess, and how you want to relate to it. But that's always stuck with me as like a road sign for keeping things in perspective.
You know, it was do you know Eddie from Blessed Unions of Soul? He's a good friend of mine and a really great person. So I had him on, and the big song comes on, I believe it was on the radio. And he said he was tarring a driveway. And he's like, hey, you know, this is me.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Yeah.
It brings you back down to reality, even totally. Though your head's in the sky.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great story. Yeah. Thank you for sharing it.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Thank you. I look forward to hearing more music from all you guys with both the Licorice Quartet and other projects you guys are coming up with. And I hope to hang out soon.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks, Joel.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, man.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rohde. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.